You know, every part of a Japanese garden is intentional and symbolic. And up next, we talk about what we can find in these beautiful and tranquil gardens. Larry Mueller here for Garden Talk. Our guest is the author of this lovely book, Japanese Gardens, Tranquility, Simplicity, Harmony. She is Gita Mehta, an adjunct professor of architecture and urban design at Columbia University in New York. She lived in Japan for 23 years, has co-authored 5 books on the country, and she has just an absolutely lovely book that we're going to talk about today and talk about Japanese gardens. And maybe you may be a fan of Japanese gardens or want to know some more about them. And I hope you'll join in. How do they make you feel when you visit? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Gita Mehta, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to put you on the spot. You start your book with a poem. Do you have it in front of you? Would you read that poem? I thought it was lovely. Would you read it to us?
Thank you. I'd be happy to read it. And I have to say before I start reading the poem that, you know, this book gave me a chance to visit so many Japanese gardens. And because our photographer insisted that it had to be before the crowds show up. So we were there very early in the morning when the dew was still on the leaves. And that experience was really spiritual for me. And that inspired the poem I wrote. So yes, with your permission, I'm very happy to read the poem.
Please do.
All right. Okay. So the poem is called Gentle Acts of Nature, Time, and Man. Between dream time and time, beyond time and thought, the fresh of the morning, a morning of the afternoon, a morning of the evening, a morning of life, a sparkling dewdrop, a garden of the soul, a garden in the soul, a garden. Gentle acts of nature, time, and me. Woven in beauty, a soul nurtured, a hoe, a shear, a seed, held for now in my transparent hands, then simply let go. From me the past, to me the future, a garden.
Oh, that's a lovely poem. And thanks so much for writing it and for including it in your book. Maybe talk about you. I just love the book, the photography and your writing. The combination of the two are wonderful. But explain to our listeners what you have in your book.
So what we try to do is we try to capture the essence of Japanese gardens. And I want to give a shout out to my co-conspirators. That's Kimie Tada, who did tons of research, and the amazing photographer, Noboru Murata. It was really a pilgrimage for me to visit all these gardens in different places in Japan and enjoy their beauty. And so that's how the book came out. And the book is actually divided into several portions. There are temple gardens, there are private gardens, and then there are public gardens. So we tried to sort of categorize them. Public gardens to make sure everyone can really have a chance to go see them. And you can also see temple gardens. But I have to say that the private gardens, you know, are disappearing. Because in Japan, land is so very expensive and to maintain these gardens is so hard. So some of the gardens are no longer there or no longer accessible to public. But anyway, there's tons in the book that you can actually go and see and enjoy.
Yeah, they're lovely. Do we have wonderful Japanese gardens in the United States?
Actually, we do. There are many Japanese gardens around the world, actually. But there's a beautiful garden in Seattle. There's a beautiful garden in Princeton. So there are several around the world. And even in Brooklyn Botanical Garden, there's a portion that is inspired by Japanese gardens. So yeah, the essence of them actually is so portable. You can carry it anywhere.
How do Japanese gardens differ from other styles of gardens? I think they're different from Chinese gardens, for example, but I think they take some inspiration, I think, as you point out in your book, from them. But talk about that.
Let me first compare to Western gardens. So in Western gardens, you're trying to tame nature. You're trying to control it. Whereas in Japanese garden, it's totally the opposite point of view, that you are learning from nature, you are in awe of nature, and you're trying to very gently mold it to become, I want to say, to mold nature to become more natural, you know, not to make it geometric or not try to, over design. It's a very gentle way of thinking about it. And you have to remember that the essence of Japanese gardens actually in history comes from temple gardens or shrine gardens. So there's like a spiritual aspect to it, which you don't see in Western architecture. Comparing to Chinese architecture, a lot of influences for Japanese architecture and gardens, they actually came with Buddhism from India, then through China, and then coming to Korea and Japan. Then the really big deal was that, these influences merged with the local essence or local design sense. And in China and India, there is an effort to, to show the exuberance. So lots, plenty of things. Whereas in Japanese garden, it's about minimalism. It's about elimination of the inessential. I want to say that's the really big difference.
It is. And you see it quite well, I think, in your descriptions, but also in the photos. There's like, if I'm recalling from your writings, there's two types of Japanese gardens in a way. There's some are to view. Mm-hmm. And others are to walk in.
Yes.
Is that correct? Yeah, go ahead, talk about that.
Yes. So the stroll gardens usually are larger, obviously, so you can stroll through them. But even then, they may be quite tiny, and they're designed in a manner that you are going round and round in the garden, but the way the garden's designed, every time you're seeing different things. So it feels much bigger than it is. So that's the stroll gardens. And then the viewing gardens are something that you don't really step into. And I'm thinking about rock gardens, dry rock gardens, particularly of Ryoanji. So then you see that you are supposed to, enjoy them like you would enjoy a painting. You would enjoy, you don't have to step into it. So they are more visual. And you have to remember that, Japan is a very condensed country. The spaces are not so large. So these viewing gardens can sometimes be, as big as some people's living room. But then you can pour the whole essence of that aesthetic into that small space,
I was reminded of another note in your writings that gardens typically are built in the United States, are built kind of around buildings. And in Japan, it's kind of the other way around that. You talk about like little tea areas or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. So actually in Heian period in Japan, the saying was that when you have a site, you first design the garden, and in the leftover space, you would design the house, right? And then the house would be designed in a manner so as to frame the views of the garden. So it's the garden that's controlling the whole thing. instead of the house, you build the house in the squat center of the plot, and then the garden is around it. So it's just really the importance you give to the garden. That's such a huge difference, right? It's a way of thinking.
It is indeed. Geeta Mehta, our guest today, she's an adjunct professor of architecture and urban design at Columbia University in New York. She's also the author of the book we're spending a little time talking about today. It's titled, lovely book. It's titled Japanese Gardens, Tranquility, Simplicity, and Harmony. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions and comments as we move along today. See, we have some emails now. You can join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Just a quick mention, we have a one-day member drive coming up on Thursday, and you don't have to wait for that drive. You can give right now and maybe ask for one of those gifts that we offer during the drive. We've got a WPR Badger tote and a Badger koozie. You can get both of them if you want. Check them out now at wpr.org/donate as we visit with Geeta Mehta, whose book is Japanese Gardens, Tranquility, Simplicity, Harmony. And again, join in 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Jeffrey sent us an email. He says there is a beautiful Japanese garden. It's called the Anderson Japanese Garden in Rockford, Illinois. And I'm just wondering if you're familiar with that particular garden.
You know, I've heard about it, but I've not visited it, and I don't know very much about it, but it's wonderful to know. Have you enjoyed that?
Jeffrey sent us an email, and I have not seen it myself, and he was just writing to, I apparently inspired him, the Japanese garden in Rockford. Let's talk about the different elements that you're going to find in a Japanese garden and their symbols. You talked a little about this, but let's go into a little more detail on that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So think about two types of Japanese gardens. They could be dry rock gardens, right? So which are completely dry, and you have these rocks usually raked by priests in some formation and beautiful to look at. So they are the viewing gardens. But in a stroll garden or other garden, you would see that the elements are again subdued. There's, of course, water. They could be running water, or they could be dry stones pretending that that's a stream. So invoking water, there could be waterfalls. You would have stones, and stones are very dear to the Japanese heart. And in a Japanese garden, they try to make the stones look as natural as possible. So usually 3/4 of the stone is under the ground. And what you're seeing is just the top of it, just like you would see in nature. Like in Chinese garden, these rocks are put like a tall rock next to a flat rock, like a stork and a turtle. But in Japanese garden, it's not that kind of symbolism. It's just simply aesthetics. You would see moss. There's so many types of moss that Japanese gardens try to cultivate. And moss takes a long time, and it has to be a particular kind of environment. So moss is a very prized item. Colors, yes, you would see colors in Japanese gardens. But you wouldn't see, like, you know, 10 different types of flowers all at once. You would, they kind of plan it so that in every season there's one amazing, like it could be cherry blossoms or it could be autumn leaves, but it's very edited, you may say, so that you're not overpowered by just many, many different colors. So they are very subdued. There would be elements that that invoke time. So you may see very old trees that are being supported by supports just to keep them standing. But then, you know, showing the impermanence of life and simplicity and the nature. So that is a very important part of Japanese gardens. So that makes a whole lot of difference to how you would view a Western garden.
Yeah, absolutely. Chris in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Chris, hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for this wonderful program. I was blessed to join my cousin in a hike around Shikoku for 3 weeks. All the cherry blossoms were in bloom. And on Shikoku, there is a pilgrimage of 88 temples. My cousin did all 88, but I only did 3 weeks. And it's exactly as the professor is saying. It's so beautiful, so moving. It is I could feel in my body the weaving of spirit and nature. And it was so profound. And staying in people's homes, what are called ryokans, where they rent out a room, I also saw the beautiful simplicity of their home. And there was one for the 60th temple called Base 60. And the...
Oh, darn, we lost her. Chris, you have some wonderful comments there. I'm sorry we lost you. Comments, Gina?
Oh, I'm so glad that Chris got to see that because... You know, you can put everything you want in a book, but it's nothing like actually being in the Japanese garden and experiencing it. So I'm so glad, Chris, that you had a chance to see that and then share with us the beauty of those cherry blossoms you saw on the pilgrimage. Yes.
Yeah. Could you describe a little more what she was talking about? It sounds like a very large area.
So Japan is actually four big islands and then lots of tiny ones. So Shikoku is one island of Japan. So the big island is called Honshu. That's where Tokyo and Kyoto and all are. And then Shikoku is a smaller island and it has pilgrimage because as you may know that in Edo period, people were not allowed to travel from one city to another unless it was on pilgrimage. So pilgrimages became very, very popular and temples on the pilgrimage thrived. And often they have temple gardens and so on. So it's very popular in Shikoku to do that 88 temple pilgrimage. You wear a white coat and at every temple they stamp on your coat so you have evidence that you were there. And that goes back to Edo period because government wanted evidence that you're actually doing a pilgrimage. You're not just, you know, escaping the Edo government. Oh. So that's about the pilgrimage. And yes, I can so imagine that Chris had a spiritual experience.
Yeah, I would bet. And she may be back. I'm not sure. We might have gotten her back. No, I guess not. I thought we had her back, but we were trying to get her back, but apparently we lost her. Well, I'm glad she called because that brought up a wonderful thing. The photos, the raking that goes on in the sands, is that sand raked every day in the temple gardens?
Those are actually very small pebbles. And they're not round, they're like angular so that when you rake them, they stay in place, you know. So very tiny pebbles. And the monks in the morning, it's their routine, you know, it's their part of their prayer. And these are junior monks. So they would get up in the morning and then there's a special kind of rake with nails in it, sort of. And then they would, to get the line completely straight and with the same level of weight on the rake, it's not easy to do. I wish I could show you my dining table garden because I made a dining table with the raked sand and then I put a glass on top. So yeah, it's so fun to do that. Yeah.
Oh, that's lovely. So Noah in Cornucopia, Wisconsin, emailed us and wonders how do Japanese gardens compare to American gardens with regard to agricultural production? Are aesthetics always a priority, or is permaculture or other means of food production relevant at all to the Japanese garden?
Yeah, I want to say that that's not the goal. The production is not the goal. There may be some fruit trees, but they probably are there for the flowers rather than the actual fruit. One thing I want to mention is that, during a Meiji Restoration way back when, and then after the war, when the food was so scarce, they actually turned a lot of Japanese gardens into agriculture gardens, and they were growing things. But then a lot of them have been reverted back to their original state, which was for pleasure and for strolling, but not necessarily for agriculture.
Yeah. There's an iris garden, is there not, in Kakigawa?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
So, one wonderful thing, if you see in the pictures in the book, is that it has big mountains in the back. And then there's this huge field of different kind of irises, right? And they look so natural, yes, they could just be blooming in this valley, but actually they're very, very carefully manicured and monitored. And the interesting thing in that garden is that the mountain in the background is part of the garden design, So in Japanese, it's called shakke. It is borrowed scenery. So you look around your garden, and if there are trees that your neighbor has, or if there's a mountain, you take that into account in your design. So that's a very interesting concept. And if your neighbor has something you don't want to see, you may build a wall just till that level, So you edit out what you don't want, and then you bring in what you want, So this iris garden, I think when you look at the pictures, you'll think it's really huge. Actually, it's not. But it's that because the mountain is part of the design. Shakke is called in Japanese, borrowed scenery.
And Joan wants to know, what is a tea garden?
Very good question. Because, in Japan, the art of drinking tea or tea ceremony, it's a very, very highly developed Zen sort of practice, right? People spend maybe decades learning how to do tea ceremony correctly. And then to learn tea ceremony, you have to learn architecture, you have to learn garden design, you have to learn calligraphy, you have to learn pottery and flower arrangements, right? Then you really, it's called the world of tea. So in this world of tea, the tea garden is actually, and there's probably a tea hut, and the tea garden leads to that hut. And this, you can think about this whole thing as theater, in the sense that when you go to this tea garden, there will probably be a gate. So when you enter it, you're in the tea garden. But your host, who's going to serve you tea, will not be in sight. The host is hiding behind because he wants you to first just take in the garden and enjoy it, right? There might even be a bench or something for you to sit at. And this whole time, the host is not around. It's you, because they want you to compose your mind and just really relax and leave behind any tension or swords or, other things. And then, so when the guest is ready and composed, then the guest gets up. And then there's a stone bath, which has probably been watered, because stones look best when they are watered. So then you would walk along the roji or the stone path towards the tea hut, and then your host will appear and welcome you, So this tea garden is a very elegant, very lovely, thoughtful kind of experience to help you compose your mind for the act of tea ceremony. And as you know, in Japanese tea ceremony, you don't talk.
Right?
Very intimate, it's very close, it's like music, music in action. That's a Japanese tea garden.
Well, I I wish we had more time to talk because I have many more questions, Gita. But I want to thank you so much for being with us today and for your book. It is a lovely book. And I hope a lot of people get to see the photos and to read your writing, which accompanies those photos so well. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you to your listeners.
Gita Mehta is an adjunct professor of architecture and urban design at Columbia University in New York, and her book is titled Japanese Gardens, Tranquility, Simplicity, Harmony. It's a wonderful book, and great to have her with us. And thank you for being with us. Thanks for joining us today. This and all of our shows are a team effort. Our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins with us today. And our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. And again, thank you for listening. And please stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.